A lawsuit against TikTok accuses company executives of hiding its effects on young people. NPR has an exclusive look into some of the documents from the case. For Friday, October 11th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Hurricane Milton caused creeks and rivers to overflow. In Clearwater, Florida, rescue crews used boats to evacuate more than 500 people from an apartment complex.
I walked into the living room where the kids were sleeping at. The water was already up to my ankle. 10 minutes later, I went back to the front door. That's when I seen water coming from underneath the door.
And Vice President Harris faces continued criticism from inside her own party about Gaza. How are protest voters that showed up in Democratic primary elections feeling now?
I'll be voting for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. I don't feel good about it.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Cleanup continues in Florida from the aftermath of Hurricane Milton. Power is out to millions, but President Biden says crews from around the country and Canada are in the state helping.
With the dedication of 50,000 power line workers, 50,000 power line workers from 43 states and the country and Canada have stepped up and come down to help.
These groups helped restore power to around 1 million Florida customers so far, but 2.1 million are still without power. Meanwhile, NPR's Greg Allen has more from Clearwater, where hundreds of people were evacuated after the storm.
The standard apartments in Clearwater aren't in an evacuation zone. They sit in a low area and have flooded before when the water rises in a nearby creek. Residents became alarmed in the early morning hours Thursday when the rising creek engulfed vehicles in the parking lot and began coming into first floor apartments. Rescues didn't commence until the worst of the storm passed. Now hundreds are wondering when they can get back in to retrieve their belongings and where they will live. Greg Allen, NPR News, Clearwater.
Two former Georgia election workers reached an undisclosed settlement with the far-right website Gateway Pundit. They sued the outlet for falsely claiming they committed fraud during the 2020 election. Sam Greenglass of member station WABE has more.
Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss served in Fulton County, which became a target of conspiracy theories amplified by former President Trump, his allies, and far-right media. The mother-daughter pair faced harassment so intense they said they had to leave their jobs and homes. According to court documents, their suit against Gateway Pundit has been settled. Lawyers for Freeman and Moss say the dispute has been resolved to the, quote, mutual satisfaction of the parties. Attorneys for Gateway Pundit owner Jim Hoff did not respond to an email. The outlet declared bankruptcy in April. Last year, Freeman and Moss won a defamation suit against former Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
The 2024 Nobel Peace Prize has gone to a Japanese organization fighting the use of nuclear weapons. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has more.
Nobel Committee Chair Jorgen Watne-Friedness said anti-nuclear group Nihon Hidankyo has helped make the nuclear option taboo for nearly 80 years.
These historical witnesses have helped to generate widespread opposition to nuclear weapons around the world by drawing on personal stories.
But he said the nuclear taboo is being pressured by nations who want nuclear weapons or who have threatened to use them in current wars, a clear reference to Iran, North Korea, and Russia.
When we look at the conflicts around the world, we see how crucial it is to uphold a nuclear taboo.
120,000 were killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, said Friedness, but modern nuclear weapons would kill millions. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR News. North Korea claims that South Korean drones entered its airspace three times this month. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul that the North warned of a military response to the incursion.
North Korea's foreign ministry said in a statement carried by state media that South Korean drones had dropped political propaganda leaflets on Pyongyang. It called the incident a grave political and military provocation, adding that the North's military was poised to attack in case of another incursion. South Korea's military denied sending drones and instead blamed the North for launching 28 salvos of balloons carrying trash into the South since May. For years, South Korean activists have sent everything from propaganda to Bibles into the North, using balloons but not drones. The increasing use of psychological warfare is part of a general rise in recent years in military tensions between the two Koreas. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
A federal appeals court judge says Sean Diddy Combs has to stay in jail while he makes a third bid for bail in his sex trafficking and racketeering case, which is slated to go to trial in May. A circuit court judge denied the hip-hop mogul's immediate release in a decision filed today, while a three-judge panel weighs his bail request. His lawyers appealed to the Second U.S. Court of Appeals September 30th after two judges rejected his release. Combs has been held at a federal jail in Brooklyn since his September 16th arrest on charges that he used his power and prestige to induce female victims to be drugged up and into sex performances. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu is available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, then gradually clearing, evening lows 38 to 42 degrees.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Hidden, though not all that effectively, in a lawsuit against TikTok, there are accusations that company executives have deceived the public about the social media app's effects on young people. One executive said TikTok could take the place of things like, quote, sleep and eating and moving around the room and looking at someone in the eyes. 13 states and Washington, D.C. filed lawsuits against TikTok this week and quoted portions of what they said were internal company documents. Those were redacted, blacked out at TikTok's request. But one of NPR's member stations got through the redactions and broke the story. To talk about it, we are joined by NPR tech correspondent Dara Kerr in Oakland, California, and Kentucky Public Radio's Sylvia Goodman in Louisville. Hey there.
Hello. Hello.
Sylvia, I want to start with you. Let's just start here. How did you get this material?
So I started by working with our enterprise capital reporter, Joe Sonka, and this complaint was filed publicly in online court filing systems like it was in states across the country. And frankly, I didn't expect it to be a big story at first. There was plenty of reporting out there in states where attorneys general had already filed. And I noticed these heavy redactions right away, as I'm sure everyone did. And I wish I could claim I used some amazing technology, but really all it took was good old copy and paste. I copy and pasted all of the information from underneath the redaction. All the text was still intact, and put it in a new document and read through all of it.
Dara, though, let's talk about the story. Tell us about some of the top findings in these documents.
Yeah, I first want to get to some context. We know that many aspects of social media is not good for us and that we should limit the time we spend on the apps. And today we're talking about TikTok, but we've seen other social media companies come under fire for a lot of the same issues. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, they've all faced congressional hearings and lawsuits. What they've shown is that social media is especially detrimental for kids. And that's because kids are more impressionable and, according to the internal documents quoted in the TikTok lawsuit, are easy to get hooked on the app. The complaint shows TikTok executives speaking rather candidly about a whole raft of dangers for kids. One internal study shows that all it takes to get addicted is 260 videos. And remember, TikTok videos are short and people tend to scroll through them. So you could really watch 260 videos in less than an hour. And TikTok has also touted these time limit tools that parents can use to control how much time their kids spend on the app. But the unredacted complaint alleges that these tools are basically worthless. The complaint has one executive saying that they're, quote, a good talking point, but, quote, not altogether effective.
Wow, a good talking point.
Yeah.
A lot of the focus in recent years on the potential harms of social media has had to do with body image and how consuming it makes us feel about body image. Was there information in the documents related to body image?
Yes, there definitely was. There was this focus on TikTok's beauty filters. And what those beauty filters do is you can overlay them over your face and make yourself look younger, thinner, have bigger eyes, fuller lips. And these filters have gotten a lot of blowback recently for creating unrealistic beauty standards, which can lead to lower self-esteem. Internally, it was clear TikTok knew this. The complaint shows employees suggesting that TikTok label these filters and stress the importance of positive body image. But that never happened. And meanwhile, in another internal report from the complaint, TikTok analyzed its main video feed and saw, quote, a high volume of what it called not attractive subjects. Kentucky's investigators found that TikTok then retooled its algorithm to amplify users that the company deemed beautiful. So these kinds of actions can just feed into the whole problem of low self-esteem in kids. And the complaint also shows that TikTok was looking to specifically hook younger kids and kids in rural areas. Sylvia, you saw some of that in the material that you uncovered in Kentucky, right?
Yeah, so obviously this was a complaint filed specifically by Kentucky's attorney general, and so large parts of it focused on specific documents that reference Kentucky. And internal reports in the complaint appear to break down the preferences and demographic data of new users classified as, quote, country rural. Kentucky's attorney general alleged it showed a particular interest in our state, but it also revealed how information is collected on really specific groups of people, including based on age and location, all the way down to the county level. The internal documents identified top preferences among new rural users, including baseball, Walmart, boat, and beer. Another document cited in the lawsuit identifies powerful federal lawmakers and listed TikTok accounts it thought could persuade them of TikTok's value as part of the company's efforts to win over said lawmakers. That includes Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, listing one potential interest as, for example, Kentucky small businesses and their accounts.
Dara, what has TikTok had to say about all of this?
TikTok objected to our reporting on these documents, and this is the first time reporters have really been able to see into some of the inner workings and thoughts at the company, and TikTok has this track record for being secretive. A spokesperson told us that the attorney general's complaint cherry-picked misleading quotes and that it used outdated and out-of-context documents. He said all of that misrepresents TikTok's commitment to community safety. And keep in mind, all of this is information in a lawsuit against TikTok.
Right. There was a development in the case yesterday. Sylvia, what was it and what might be happening next?
So after our initial reporting, the attorney general did move to seal the complaint, citing confidentiality agreements, and the judge accepted that motion. TikTok also wants this out of the public eye, as we've noted, and each lawsuit will unfold individually through state courts. And so we may see different strategies and outcomes depending on the state we're looking at. There's a chance, for example, that some states settle. They agree to, you know, some changes in the algorithm maybe, or paying fines, but some attorneys general have definitely expressed interest in taking this to trial. And if nothing else, I think we can be confident that this is going to take a very long time.
That is Kentucky Public Radio's Sylvia Goodman, as well as NPR's Dara Kerr. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks,
Scott.
The presidential race could come down to slim margins in just a handful of swing states, which means, as we all know, every vote counts in places like Michigan and Wisconsin. One lasting issue that could hurt Vice President Kamala Harris is the criticism from some within her own party over the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters reports.
On the final evening of the Democratic National Convention this summer in Chicago, Michigan delegate Abbas Alawiyev addresses a large scrum of reporters outside the United Center.
This is a watershed moment where Americans all across the country, where Democrats all across the country are saying, "Free Palestine!"
Free Palestine! Free Palestine! Aloia helped launch the Uncommitted movement in Michigan. It led to some Democratic voters across the country protesting President Biden's stance on Gaza by selecting uncommitted or uninstructed on their ballots. 36 uncommitted delegates were allocated to the convention. That's less than 1% of the more than 3,800 who were pledged to President Biden and ultimately supported Harris. In Chicago, they staged a sit-in demanding a Palestinian American address the convention. While unsuccessful in getting a speaker on stage, Alawiya did not sound defeated.
This is the Democratic Party. This is the coalition we are building for the next 4 years for equal rights for all.
But now it's October, and many within the protest movement are still not pleased.
Yeah, I'll be voting for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. I don't feel good about it.
That's Sam Doten, an uncommitted delegate from Minnesota, the state that sent the most to the convention. Doten has been active in organizing for Democrats in the past, but says this year he's not volunteering for the Harris campaign.
I'm talking about hitting doors, you know, talking to all my friends, encouraging them to vote for this ticket, and they've made it impossible for me to put in that work and take that position.
Other delegates say they're still trying to make up their minds. Some say they're voting third party or even leaving the top of the ballot blank. Leaders of the National Uncommitted Movement are not endorsing Harris or former President Donald Trump or third party options. Just this week, the group posted a video online where a co-founder said the situation could get much worse under Trump. The voters who protested in the primary election are now left to decide on their own. Taher Herzala is a Minnesotan PhD student with family in Gaza. He says he's not voting for the Democratic ticket.
On November 6th, we'll be able to say we told you so in the event that, you know, Donald Trump or somebody else wins the presidency.
Herzala says he can't forgive top Democrats for the Biden administration's policies in the region. Some Democrats offer a warning for not backing their presidential candidate.
Donald Trump was a disaster for human rights all around the world, and he would be an even worse disaster for the Palestinian people.
That's former Michigan Congressman Andy Levin. He notes it was Trump who pushed to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a longstanding goal of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Levin made the comments during a virtual summit of Engage last week, one of the nation's largest Muslim American voter mobilization groups, which endorsed Harris and Walz. Governor Walz also joined the summit.
We all know on here this war must end, and it must end now. The vice president's working every day to ensure that.
But that message isn't changing how some of these dissatisfied voters are feeling going into Election Day. Matt Grossman, a political scientist at Michigan State University, says the uncommitted movement has been successful at raising attention about how Democrats talk about and mobilize around the Middle East.
That just doesn't necessarily translate into actual changes in U.S. foreign policy, especially when there's a longstanding alliance that they're trying to disrupt and a lot of people mobilizing on the other side as well.
Now, those Democratic voters who hope they could change their candidate's foreign policy position have to commit to how they think their vote can best help reach that goal. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology. Program is supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 24th at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project.
On this date, on October 11th, 1987, a northern shrike appears in my neighborhood. Spends several minutes swooping and diving at some blue jays and a robin or two. He is repulsed in his attacks and unsuccessful. He will go away hungry from this endeavor. But that is not always the case, because the northern shrike is a pretty efficient predator. For a songbird, it is a meat eater, which is a bit unusual. It doesn't have the talons of a hawk, but it does have the hooked beak, and it will make quick work of any mouse or small bird or salamander that it catches, oftentimes hanging the carcass on a bramble of blackberries or the barbed wire of a fence in order to prove its prowess as a mate to any female who might be in the area.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Lisa, a mattress brand who believes good sleep should come naturally. Lisa donates mattresses to nonprofits across the U.S. to improve their communities. Learn more about Lisa at leesa.com. From Insperity, providing HR services and technology, from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at insperity.com/HR Matters. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. This week, NPR is reporting from Israel to Gaza and beyond to look at the ways life has changed for those affected by the events of October 7th, a year on. Palestinian citizens of Israel make up a fifth of the Israeli population. After the State of Israel was created in 1948, a minority of Palestinians who did not flee or get expelled from their homes were granted citizenship and placed under military rule for the first 20 years. Today, many live and work alongside Jewish Israelis. They speak fluent Arabic and Hebrew. Some were killed in the Hamas-led attacks on Israel that triggered the war in Gaza. But after October 7th, they say they live in an atmosphere of fear. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi takes us to Jaffa, the Arab-majority district of Tel Aviv.
Walking through central Jaffa, around me are shops with both Arabic and Hebrew signs. Many women wearing hijab, and Palestinians and Jews share spaces in coffee shops, stores, and restaurants. This shared and tense life was never easy for Palestinians before October 7th, and now they say it's all been upended in the smallest ways. Abu Yahya changes the wheel of a bicycle in his shop in Jaffa. He's always had a mix of Arab and Jewish customers and friends. But after October 7th, he says he's viewed with suspicion by his Jewish neighbors. The way they look at you is different now, Abu Yahya says. He says he's lost Jewish customers. They walk in, see you're an Arab, and walk out, Abu Yahya says. Palestinians in Jaffa have deep ties to fellow Palestinians in Gaza. Abu Yahya says some of his relatives there have been killed in the war. Just a few miles away, families of Israeli hostages taken by Hamas have set up Hostage Square in central Tel Aviv, with tents and art installations and memorials to October 7th victims. But Abu Yahya hasn't held any memorials for his killed relatives. He says he doesn't want his Jewish neighbors to mistake his grief for support for Hamas. I don't even dare to write the words, "Rest in peace" on Facebook to mourn my cousin, he says. Sami Abu Shadeh is a prominent Jaffa politician who served in the Israeli parliament.
I was attacked physically and verbally a few times on the streets. Here in Jaffa, a lot of the Muslim women that wore scarves were attacked on the public transportation. And part of them now are afraid to go to hospitals or to go to visit a doctor because they are attacked on the streets because they are not Jewish.
Many Palestinian citizens of Israel are prominent members of the community, and some helped treat the injured on October 7th.
On the same day, they were rescued by Arab Palestinians. Those who were injured, they were dealt with Arab doctors in the hospital.
Yonah Rosenbaum is a Jewish resident of the mixed city of Haifa. He says he understands the concerns of Palestinians in his city. Most Arabs are afraid of being arrested and harmed. They don't express themselves freely, he says. Ahmed Khalife waves from his front door. We meet him at his doorstep. It's illegal for him to go any further. The 42-year-old human rights lawyer has been under house arrest for almost 10 months. On October 19th, Khalife was arrested during an anti-war demonstration in his town, Umm al-Fahim. That's an Arab town in northern Israel. Khalife was chanting slogans he says were in support of Palestinian victims of the war in Gaza. They were saying, "Gaza, don't sway. You are full of dignity and glory." Khalifa was charged for incitement of terrorism and identifying with a terrorist organization based on those slogans. He spent 4 months in jail, where he says he was beaten, given very little to eat, and where the cells were overcrowded and filthy.
People were begging for their lives and crying.
The atmosphere was full of fear that you can die any second.
The Israeli police told NPR that it operates in accordance to the law and was unfamiliar with, quote, the claims described.
We are living in a political body that claims to be a democratical state, but it's a Jewish democracy that we have no place.
NPR spoke to many Palestinian citizens of Israel who were jailed for social media posts supporting an end to the war or who were harassed in public. They were all afraid to go on record, even anonymously. The Israeli Parliament's research division says that 84 indictments of incitement to terrorism were filed between 2018 and 2022, mainly against Arabs. That number has more than doubled since the outbreak of the war. Last October, Israel's police commissioner, Kobi Shabtai, made his position clear. Whoever wants to be a citizen of Israel, welcome, he said. Whoever wants to identify with Gaza is welcome. I will put them on a bus headed there. Maysan Amorani is a lawyer with the rights group Adala who represents Khalifa. She says Israeli courts used to be more sympathetic to her clients, but not since October 7th.
I'm standing there arguing the same things that argued before that led to the release of a lot of people. I'm getting to a dead end with the court, with the judges, with the attorney general.
Even the judges are harsher, she says.
They just look at me and say, and many times we get this answer, what was before the 7th of October is not what's happening after the 7th of October.
We reached out to the Israeli Justice Department, but they didn't respond with comment. In the Jabalia Mosque in Jaffa, Imam Bilal Dakke leads about 10 men in afternoon prayers. Palestinian Muslims come to find spiritual guidance from Dakke at a time of anguish. But even the preacher says he's avoiding any reference to the war. Any Friday sermon about Gaza and the police will arrest you, he says. Dekke says many in his congregation come to ease their pain over the war in private. I tell them to be patient, Dekke says, that there's a mighty God above. In the heart of Jaffa last week, a deadly shooting exposed these tensions. At the very same moment sirens wailed during an Iranian missile attack, two Palestinian men from the Israeli-occupied West Bank opened fire at a Jaffa light rail station. Police said seven people were killed. Hamas claimed responsibility. Israeli Shai Peretz witnessed the shooting. The Arabs of Jaffa are a danger, he told reporters. Anyone who harms us will be dealt with an iron fist. During the attack, one shooter ran into a nearby mosque and warned worshippers not to leave. Later, far-right Minister of National Security Itamar Ben-Gvir came to the scene. If a connection is found to the mosque, we need to close it, to demolish it, Ben-Gvir said. There was no connection, Israeli police later said. But once again, Palestinian citizens were caught in the middle. Arabs were among those wounded, and yet they were blamed. Iran Nissan is a Jewish medic who treated the wounded and told Israeli TV that the security minister Ben-Gvir was exploiting the horrific attack. Jews and Arabs are trying to build a life together, Nissan said. A life that Palestinian citizens of Israel struggle to navigate as the war in Gaza continues. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You can hear more stories of lives changed since October 7th on NPR's State of the World podcast. You can find it on your favorite podcast player or the NPR app. This is NPR News.
The small African kingdom of Eswatini might not be the first place you'd look for rising country music stars, but the duo Dusty and Stone's rural upbringing there gave them an uncanny proximity to country music's themes.
They were living the stories of Dolly Parton, and they were living the stories of Hank Williams.
A new documentary explores their dream to make it in America. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Tune in to new music to hear the best of the new Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays at 2 and 10 p.m. and Sundays at noon. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Adventures in Lifelong Learning meets every Tuesday morning at the Bemidji Eagles Club, now through November 12th. Refreshments served at 9:30 with various speakers at 10 a.m. each meeting. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation is continuing its efforts to bring home tribal members who were deceived by fraudulent sober living homes in Arizona. The homes targeted Native people with false promises of assistance and left them stranded. KSUT Tribal Radio's Crystal Ashkey reports.
Vulnerable tribal members were lured with false promises of treatment for substance abuse. Instead of receiving the care they were promised, they were caught in a scam that defrauded Arizona's Medicaid program of nearly $3 billion. Thousands were left struggling with untreated addiction and stranded far from home, many on the streets, while their families were unaware of their whereabouts. In response, the Navajo Nation launched Operation Rainbow Bridge, an initiative to help bring home the estimated 5,000 to 7,000 tribal members affected by the fraud. Lieutenant Robert Williams of the Navajo Nation Police Department says this is an ongoing effort to locate relatives and loved ones who remain stranded in the Phoenix area.
When I talk about our relatives and loved ones, I'm not just talking about Diné people. I'm talking about any Native relative we might have down there in that area. During Operation Rainbow Bridge, we did encounter members of other nations. And I know we encountered some folks in Cherokee Nation and some other nations further back east. So that effort continues to provide resources for those family members and loved ones who want to get home out of that situation.
Despite the crackdown on these fraudulent operations, Williams says authorities are still investigating reports that some facilities continue to operate and target tribal members.
I think we'd be naive to say we stopped it because it's driven by money. There are greedy people who want money, and stopping that, you know, that's a lot of the cause of criminality is that greed. So we have to remain ever vigilant to protect those who are maybe having trouble protecting themselves, maybe due to addictions, alcohol or drug addictions. You know, they might not be able to help themselves at that moment in time when these people contact them. We will constantly keep our eyes and ears out, and we ask the public to do the same. Let's look for people who are unscrupulous and are willing to take advantage of those people who are just ravaged by addiction.
Arizona lawmakers this year failed to pass legislation to tighten regulations governing these facilities. They are expected to consider new legislation in 2025. I'm Crystal Ashkey.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer declared Friday, October 11th, Native American Veterans Day in the state. The day honors Native American men and women who have served in the armed forces of the U.S. The proclamation states Native American communities have fostered the warrior spirit that exemplifies the qualities of strength, honor, pride, devotion, and wisdom, with Native Americans enlisting at higher rates per capita than any other ethnic group. The day is also to draw awareness to challenges Native veterans face today, including access to health care and benefits. According to the governor's office, there are more than 140,000 Native American veterans living in the U.S. and Puerto Rico, with more than 2,500 in Michigan. The grassroots group Protect the Sacred is hosting a Native Vote event on the Navajo Nation this weekend with Hollywood stars. The Walk to the Polls, honoring 100 years of citizenship and beyond, is an effort to mobilize Native voters. The event is scheduled to take place Saturday in Fort Defiance and Window Rock, Arizona, and is expected to feature Native and non-Native celebrities and tribal leaders. The group has hosted other Native vote events, including bull riding, skateboarding, and a horse ride to the polls. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. We'll be right back.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The World Indigenous Business Forum comes to Albuquerque October 28th through the 30th. Speakers include Rachel Patero of Rise Global presenting on Women Take the Lead on Business to Change the Future of Their Community.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. 2 days after Hurricane Milton battered Florida, communities across the state are still dealing with flooding from rivers and creeks. The storm dropped as much as 19 inches of rain on some parts of Pinellas County. The county sits on a peninsula in the middle of Tampa Bay and is very susceptible to flooding. In Clearwater, rescue crews helped more than 500 people evacuate from an apartment complex because of flooding from a nearby creek. NPR's Greg Allen reports residents are wondering now if they'll ever be able to return.
Masada Harris was looking out his window at the Standard Apartments in Clearwater as Milton roared through early Thursday morning.
So I'm seeing cars move, so I'm wondering, like, well, where are they going? And as I sat there and the last truck moved and I seen like a water wave. I thought I seen a water wave, so I'm like, oh, hold on.
Harris was relatively lucky. His apartment is on the second floor of this sprawling older complex. When he saw the flooding, he ran out and moved his car to higher ground in a nearby shopping center. By the time he got back to his building, he says he realized his family and all the residents were in trouble.
In that moment there, we had a neighbor downstairs and they opened their door because they was in the house the whole time. So they opened their door and all the water rushed in their house. So we helped them get out, and once the water was up to our waistline at that point.
In his part of the complex, Harris says the water was 4 feet deep. In other sections, it was neck deep. They live next to Alligator Creek. When authorities told him and his family they had to evacuate, they waded out nervously through the murky floodwaters.
Now, even on a day when it's not raining, I've actually seen alligators, just small alligators walking around the apartment complex. So that's another thing that I was scared of. We're in pitch black, we're in the water, waist deep, and I'm thinking like, oh my God, alligators and snakes.
Harris and his family are staying with a cousin now. Today, he and other residents gathered outside the apartment complex in hopes they could get back in to retrieve what they could from their flooded homes and vehicles. Angela Gonzalez wanted to get baby clothes and supplies for her daughter, who evacuated with her newborn.
They told us that nobody can go in because there's alligators in the middle. I mean,
yeah, you don't believe that, do
you? I really don't.
Law enforcement personnel and the building's management said they wanted to make sure it was safe before they allowed residents back in temporarily. Kelvin Glenn was there today to see if he could retrieve some medicine from his flooded first floor apartment. He recalls what it was like in the early morning hours on Thursday. He woke up and realized water was coming in.
So I walked into the living room where the kids were sleeping at. The water was already up to my ankle. And then within about 2 o'clock, sir, water was already waist to the waist right
waist
here.
Waist deep.
And I already got the kids with me. I'm talking about I got kids from the ages of 17, 16, 14, 13, 8, and 3 years old.
Glenn called 911, but was told rescue crews couldn't respond until the worst of the storm passed. He says his kids spent the next 2 hours perched on a table until he could find a flashlight and get them upstairs to a neighbor's apartment. A few hours later, rescue crews arrived and used boats to evacuate Glenn and his family. The flood, he says, took his car and everything they owned.
Stuff can be replaced, but your life can be replaced. So I tell anybody who's been through this, who haven't witnessed it, and I'm the one who witnessed it, don't mess around when it comes to a hurricane because it'll freak you out.
Glenn says the complex had minor flooding several times while he's lived there, but nothing like this. The apartment building is not in an evacuation zone, and residents say no one told them before the storm that they should leave. After this, Glenn doubts that any apartments in the complex will be livable. He's focused now on finding a new place to live and says fortunately he has insurance for his possessions and his vehicles. Greg Allen, NPR News, Clearwater, Florida.
Former President Donald Trump held a rally this afternoon in Aurora, Colorado, after weeks of pushing false stories about the city's migrant community.
What the hell is happening with our country? What are they doing? What are they doing to Colorado? They're ruining They're ruining your state.
The Republican nominee is not expected to win Colorado, but Trump is seizing on challenges Aurora has faced and the misleading ways he and his allies have talked about those challenges to paint undocumented immigrants as a threat to the country. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is in Aurora and joins me now. Hey, Franco.
Hey, Scott.
Let's start with this. What is the Trump campaign's argument for going to Aurora?
I mean, he says the city is a war zone. I mean, he's doing is, you know, using kind of Aurora to draw attention to the Biden-Harris policies on the border, which, as we know, is his signature attack against Vice President Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. Here's more of what he had to say.
Kamala has imported an army of illegal alien gang members and migrant criminals from the dungeons of the third world. They come from the dungeons, think of that, the dungeons of the third world.
So these are exaggerated claims that he says is nowhere that is more evident than here in Aurora, where he says these same criminals have taken over local apartment complexes.
And this is part of a bigger trend that we've seen a lot in the last few weeks. I mean, it's pretty similar to the false debunked stories that he's been promoting about Springfield, Ohio, and Haitian migrants. I mean, we all remember him talking about eating cats and dogs in the debate, which, again, wasn't true.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Trump is using both Springfield and Aurora to justify his calls for, you know, the biggest mass deportation program in history. But the reality on the ground in Aurora is very different than what Trump is portraying. I mean, I'm here. I went to that apartment complex where this all started. I spoke with families who live all around that block. I mean, Aurora is a large metropolitan area with nearly a 500,000 residents. It's very diverse with many working class neighborhoods. There's also large sections that are basically Denver suburbs made of manicured subdivisions, golf courses, and even hipster food halls.
You mentioned an apartment complex where this all began. Can you rewind a little and remind us how Aurora became such a flashpoint for this issue?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to a video of armed men roaming around that apartment complex, which went viral among right-wing outlets. Mm-hmm. Trump actually shared parts of the video today during the rally and repeatedly claimed that members of a Venezuelan gang had overrun the city. He actually said they had overrun the state. Now, the Republican mayor of Aurora calls the claims grossly exaggerated and says the incidents were limited to a few apartment complexes, but that hasn't stopped Trump from promoting these false stories and you know, basically to stoke supporters. I mean, he even promised, if elected, to launch a new program, which he called Operation Aurora, that would target the removal of Venezuelan gang members.
I will rescue Aurora and every town that has been invaded and conquered.
Franco, we've seen over the last few decades Colorado go from a swing state to more and more of a comfortably Democratic state. So why is Trump spending his time and resources there?
Well, Trump has continued to escalate his rhetoric about illegal immigration as the campaign nears its final stretch. But again, talking about immigrant evasion and a country in chaos is, you know, a signature issue. And you are right, Colorado is a solid blue state. Biden beat Trump here by 14 percentage points 4 years ago. But what local officials say Trump is doing, and you can see it here on the ground, is that he is exploiting real but isolated incidents to basically fuel this larger narrative that is at the crux of his campaign.
Right. That's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Oscar-winning writer and director Alfonso Cuarón is best known for his movies like Children of Men and Roma. Now he's back with an Apple TV Plus series called Disclaimer. It stars Cate Blanchett as a successful journalist with a secret. NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says it is a carefully executed thriller built for the streaming age.
To understand the themes explored in Disclaimer, consider these words from CNN star Christiane Amanpour, who kicks off the first episode handing a prestigious award to Cate Blanchett's character, successful documentarian Catherine Ravenscroft.
Beware of narrative and form.
Their power can bring us closer to the truth, but they can also be a weapon with a great power to manipulate.
Sounds like a particularly ominous piece of media criticism, but what it really is, of course, is foreshadowing, presaging an event which could unravel Catherine's perfect life. A book arrives, anonymously sent in the mail, which tells the story of a personal secret so explosive, Catherine tries to burn it in front of her clueless husband, played by Sacha Baron Cohen.
It's about me.
Why are you burning this book?
Well, it was sent to me, and I think I'm being punished.
Punished? Do they name you?
No, they don't name me, but they describe me.
Describe you how? White, blonde, beautiful, gorgeous, successful.
None of those things, and something in that book made me hate myself all over again.
Disclaimer is a carefully built limited series assembled by Alfonso Cuarón, a Mexican director known for ambitious films like Gravity and Roma. Cuarón cast accomplished American actor Kevin Kline as Stephen Brigstock, a quietly cautious British widower and retired private school teacher. He blames Catherine for the death of his son, which happened after the two met years ago. Brigstock vows revenge through circulating the book.
I was the one who was going to destroy her in real life. But first she had to suffer. The book would sniff her out from her hiding place and chase her into the open.
Disclaimer is a tale about storytelling and assumptions. Catherine's perfect life is threatened by the destructive power of assumptions many make upon reading the book, and her struggle to escape them develops into a spellbinding thriller. But while Klein's character reveals his thoughts directly to the viewer in his narrations, Catherine's thoughts are rendered by a different voice speaking about her, like in this moment when Catherine muses on gently dismissive thoughts about her endearingly entitled husband's love for wine.
Wine is Robert's thing, particularly fine Bordeaux. You can barely taste the difference between red and white wine, but you enjoy sharing your husband's pleasure.
This gives the audience some distance from Catherine's thoughts, which become more important as the plot takes unexpected twists. Now, it's tough to explain how the story changes without dropping spoilers. Klein and Blanchett's characters are bound together by terrible tragedies which lead to horrific actions. Some might feel the plot, crafted by writer-director Cuarón and based on a 2015 novel by Renee Knight, is too predictable and outlandish. But I found myself swept away by Cuarón's patient, attentive style. It's a story perfectly made for streaming, using every second of its 7-episode run to craft a tale which seems to be one thing, only to become another with a shocking twist at the end. Here's hoping a few other folks working in streaming TV are paying close attention. I'm Eric Deggans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Setlist on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows in Duluth, Gilbert, Bemidji, and Aiken. Starting things off in Duluth, Wusso's Concert Cafe is hosting 1 week live every night this week through Saturday. It is the 22nd edition of this week-long festival with multiple performers each night from around the Twin Ports and northeastern Minnesota. Live recordings taken from the shows will make up the album 1 Week Live Volume 22, a long-running album showcase of the music scene in the area. And musicians this year include Minor Moon, the Urban Hillbilly Quartet, and the Penny Peaches. Again, that is each night at Wusso's Concert Cafe in West Duluth through Saturday. On Thursday, you can catch Mark Joseph at the Ore House in Gilbert at 7 p.m. A songwriter and guitarist who plays many genres like Americana, blues, country, and rock. He's also a former guitarist for Minnesota jam band The Big Woo and released his fourth solo album, Palisade Peach, at the end of 2023. Thursday night, 7 p.m. in Gilbert. On to Saturday at 7 o'clock, you can catch the blues jam duo Brothers Burn Mountain at Bemidji Brewing. Ryan and Jesse Dermody have a one-of-a-kind live show that features extended, improvised jams, lengthy drum solos, and even instrument swapping. And at the same time, in Aiken, folk duo Morning Bird will be at Sampaguita. Violinist Jill Burks and guitarist Rob Wheeler share vocals with their mix of original songs and traditionals. Their debut album, Echoes in the Meadow, came out earlier this year. That show is Saturday in Aiken at Santa Guida at 7 p.m. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxe.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. A grassroots anti-nuclear weapons organization from Japan has won this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Its members are survivors of the August 1945 U.S. nuclear bomb attacks on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Nobel Committee said the organization has helped create a taboo against the use of nuclear weapons, one that is threatened today. NPR's Elnor Beardsley reports.
To the Japanese organization, Nihon Hidankyo.
When the news reached anti-nuclear weapons organization Nihon Hidankyo that they just won this year's Nobel Peace Prize, there was astonishment and tears of joy. Never did I dream this could happen, said the organization's co-head and Hiroshima survivor Toshiyuki Mimaki. It can't be real. Nobel Committee Chair Jorgen Watt-Friedness said the group, founded in 1956, has been instrumental in creating a post-World War II taboo against nuclear weapons.
These historical witnesses have helped to generate and consolidate widespread opposition to nuclear weapons around the world by drawing on personal stories.
Nobel Peace Prize watchers were expecting an award linked to one of the many wars currently raging across the planet. Friedness said Ukraine, Gaza, and Sudan were top of mind when the Nobel Committee made its decision.
When we look at the developments and the conflicts around the world, we see how crucial it is to uphold a nuclear taboo.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
That's President Harry Truman breaking the news to the American people on August 6, 1945. The atom bombs ended World War II but caused death and horrific suffering and destruction. It's the last time nuclear weapons have been used in conflict, but the Nobel Committee said the nearly 80-year taboo is under pressure.
The nuclear powers are modernizing and upgrading their arsenals. New countries appear to be preparing to acquire nuclear weapons, and threats are being made to use nuclear weapons as part of ongoing warfare.
It was a clear message to Iran, who many believe is trying to acquire a nuclear bomb, and North Korea, which is pushing to expand its nuclear arsenal, and Russia, where Vladimir Putin recently lowered the threshold for when it would launch a nuclear attack. NATO has also announced a major nuclear exercise just next week. The Nobel Committee's Friedness said Nihon Hidankyo and its crucial witnesses to nuclear destruction will soon no longer be among us.
But with a strong culture of remembrance and continued commitment, new generations in Japan are carrying forward the experience and the message of the witnesses.
120,000 people were killed in the nuclear bombs in 1945.
But today's nuclear weapons have far greater destructive power.
The Nobel Committee says they could kill millions and would impact the climate catastrophically. Simply put, nuclear war would destroy civilization. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Many of us have had a falling out with someone we love. We think about them and miss them, but the prospect of trying to make things right can be daunting. For many Jews, these relationships are top of mind in the weeks leading up to Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which starts tonight at sundown. NPR's Sarah Ventry spoke with one woman attempting to end years of estrangement this high holiday season.
In the fall of 2021, Nancy Pines couldn't bring herself to pick up the phone and call her friend.
I deliberately avoided her street. I deliberately hoped I wouldn't run into her at the grocery store.
Pines is 67, and she's been friends with this woman for decades. Over the years, though, there were disagreements and hurt feelings. And then one day, it was just too much, and they stopped talking. This time of year, Pines thinks about it a lot.
I'm just more aware of it in the period leading up to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, well, Slichot.
Slichot is the service that happens just before the Jewish New Year. The word Slichot means pardons. The service is designed to help you reflect on the ways in which you've fallen short in the past year, the mistakes you've made, and the people you've hurt.
Let's stand together on page 4 as we read these words that we'll hear many more times during this season. Al chet shechatanu lefanecha ba'onas v'ratzon. Sin we have committed against you under duress.
This is the Slichot service Pines went to at Temple Micah in Washington, D.C. And the reason this prayer is said so many times is because the high holiday season requires constant self-examination. Rabbi Chana Leslie Glazer is an interim rabbi in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
Yom Kippur is seen as this really special window where if you express actual regret and you ask to be absolved, then God will absolve anything, literally anything. There is one little caveat, though. If you don't make right with the other people that you've hurt, then that can't be forgiven.
For Pines, tonight marks the fourth Yom Kippur since she's been out of regular contact with her friend, who isn't Jewish. Pines couldn't reach out for the last 3 years.
And somehow this closure on this reconciliation with this friend just was carried over from year to year. Now it's time, and I think I'm ready.
Pines has been thinking a lot about what she'll say.
I can tell it's emotional now, and I can feel the lump in my throat, and I may burst into tears, which she doesn't always understand. And when I pick up the phone to call, too much time has gone by. I miss you, and I hope we can find some time soon to talk.
Rabbi Glazer explains that traditionally there are 4 steps to repentance. 1, admit what you've done wrong and stop doing it. 2, confess. 3, have regret.
And then number 4 is probably the most important one, is to figure out how not to repeat the action.
For years, Pines was stuck between those steps.
I could be in services for hours on end and think about things, but I'm a feeler and I'm a doer. And it's time to act.
So this year, she finally did reach out.
I was anxious. I was really anxious. And I didn't want to pick up the phone and call. She's not a phone person. So I texted.
She asked how her friend was doing and if they could talk in person.
She wrote back, you know, minutes later. And she said, "Hi, Nancy. Thank you for being in touch. I'm willing to get together. But right now, I'm the one with, quote unquote, too many things going on."
Pines plans to sit down with her friend, but she knows there's still a lot of work to do, and it won't be done before sundown. Still, she's relieved to have taken these first steps. Sarah Ventry, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley-Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Check out playlist podcasts and more at KAXE.org. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. KXE has built connections between listeners, community organizations, and local businesses in northern Minnesota since 1976. Consider becoming a business or community sponsor to help KAXE build strong connections now and into the future. Text the word SPONSOR to 218-326-1234. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, then gradually clearing. Evening lows 38 to 42 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 50s. Slight chance for showers in the afternoon. Calm wind. Good chances for showers in the evening.